a team lead is what they call it. And so they describe him just walking into that pen and just started shooting. They describe it going, you know, hearing this pop, 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 and the weird vision that seems surreal to a lot of them of just coworker after coworker falling on the ground. We know a few things, like it was a handgun. He shot many people. It seemed to begin from outside the store and culminated in that break room.
One more thing really quick, William. Third mass shooting in Virginia in about 2 weeks. I mean, how are people there handling things?
It's just, it's difficult. Just, you know, 10 days ago, I was covering the University of Virginia shooting. There's a lot of people shaken up.
William Wan, thanks a lot, William.
Thank you.
Let's hear next from Democratic State Senator Eloise Lucas of Virginia. The tragedy in Chesapeake is in her district. Senator, before we get to gun control, I just want to know how Chesapeake is coping on this Thanksgiving Day.
Well, you know, holidays are really tough for some people anyway. And right now we have our readiness is in mourning because when it first happened, people were in shock. They were just couldn't believe that it had come so close to home. And then once the reality set in, after the names started being released, people were in mourning of how people were feeling. People were rushing around still, getting prepared for the holidays, but clearly in their minds was the tragedy that just happened in Chesapeake. And so people are mourning. I mean, people who didn't know any of these individuals or any of the victims are mourning. As I was walking through the different malls, people were saying, "This is such a tragic thing. When are we going to do something about gun violence protection?" And that's just clearly what's on the minds of people that I've had an opportunity to speak to. They are fearful for their lives because nobody knows where the next incident is going to happen. So we are a region that's in shock. We're in mourning. It's a tough time because, as I indicated earlier, holidays are tough enough for some people. And to have this tragedy on top of all of that is just unimaginable.
And so on that, on solutions, because Virginia has had an awful run of shootings just in the past couple of weeks. You've said that the only real solution to mass shootings is gun control. And Democrats in your state, Senator, were able to do that in 2020. You're able to tighten control, gun control. But now Republicans control the House and the governor's office. So how possible is that now?
Well, I'd like to refer to it more as gun violence prevention. Gun violence prevention is the operative term for us. In order to get there, we've got to get a grip on how we limit access to firearms to people who should not. Firearm prevention, violent prevention, but we need to do so much more. The bill that I introduced for universal background checks needs to be tightened up. We need to do something about firearms of mass destruction. And so there's so much more that we can do. Legislators finally come to the reality that they are sitting back allowing their constituents to be killed in these mass shootings because of our failure. When I say our failure, I'm talking about all elected officials to do something to curb or curtail this violent and violent streak that we're experiencing.
So, Senator, not real quick, you mentioned
all across the state.
You mentioned President Biden. I know that earlier this year, Congress passed the first bipartisan gun control bill in decades. And poll after poll shows that Americans favor most of its provisions. Given a level of support like that, why do you think there is so little lawmaking on this? Just about 30 seconds, Senator.
Okay. It's because of the legislators themselves. They just don't have the backbone, the spine, to stand up to the NRA and do what's necessary just to even save the lives of their constituents. And again, President Biden has done a great thing, but he needs the support of his other elected officials.
That's Virginia State Senator Eloise Lucas. Senator, happy Thanksgiving to you and your family and your community.
We'll do the best we can. Thank you so much.
Over the coming weeks, we're hearing from young adults living in multi-generational households, people in their 20s and 30s living with their parents and grandparents. For many families, it's a cultural tradition. It's a custom that's also broadened in recent years. To understand why, let's hear the story of one woman in Houston. Here's NPR's Claire Murashima.
Growing up in Houston, Jennifer Moreno and her dad often butted heads. He was always in survival mode, and she was more level-headed. He'd get frustrated when she'd translate. Then, her grandmother started staying with the family intermittently. Before Jennifer's grandmother died, she told stories about her son, Jennifer's dad, that he'd never shared.
He's not just my dad. He was also, you know, somebody's son. He was also somebody who grew up in rural Mexico and had all these random adventures that I didn't realize he had.
Learning about his past has helped them form a deeper relationship, and it helped Jennifer and her dad finally see each other as adults. And that's a big deal to her, because living with her parents is about more than just housing. It's her full-time job. Jennifer's 29 and looks after her brother, who's diagnosed with autism late in his childhood. After her mom had a fall at home, Jennifer also became her full-time caregiver and took over her duties as a head of household. She makes sure everyone's awake in the morning, cooks them dinner every night, and everything in between. On top of that, that's Jennifer warming up her vocal cords for one of her side hustles. When she's not looking after her mom and brother, she freelances as a writer and translator to help make ends meet. Her family lives paycheck to paycheck. Natasha Pilkauskas is an associate professor of public policy at the University of Michigan. She studies children living in multigenerational households.
In terms of multigenerational households, the kind of people who tend to live in them tend to have fewer economic resources. It's also much more common amongst non-white families.
These setups are also higher among immigrant families like Jennifer's, whose parents both came to the U.S. from Mexico.
It's very surprising to me, in some senses, that it hasn't kind of plateaued so far.
A 2021 Pew Research study found that 1 in 4 Americans live in multigenerational households, which they define as 2 or more adult generations living under the same roof. It's been on the rise for the asked to look after her mom and brother.
It's kind of like they avoided the subject because they didn't want to force that idea on me. They were just kind of hoping that I'd willingly take care of them.
Pew also told us that almost a quarter of people 25 to 34 living multigenerationally say that caregiving is a major reason for their living arrangement.
At the end of the day, I took on the role because I felt like that's what I had to do in terms of I'm the only person my mom trusts with her care, and it seemed really mean to not be there for her.
So until the day comes when they no longer need her care, Jennifer is staying put in her parents' home. Claire Murashima, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, 19 minutes after 8. And happy Thanksgiving. I'm Peter Bryant in for Hope Kerwin today. We have music for Thanksgiving coming up starting at 9 o'clock. Stephanie Elkins brings you morning classics, and that will include between 10 and noon today performances by middle and high school students from around the state, part of the Wisconsin School Music Association Honors Concerts. That and more coming up today, music between 9 and 3.
On the next Peanuts, Saturday is the centennial of his birth. Also from our archive, an interview with Chuck Jones, the animator and director who helped bring to life Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck and created The Roadrunner. Join us.
You can hear Fresh Air tonight starting at 7 on WPR.
Support for WPR comes from the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin. Dedicated to protecting the state's lands, waters, and wildlife, and connecting all people with nature in Wisconsin. More is at wisconservation.org.
From the WGTD Arts and Events calendar, the Gifts of Nature program returns to the Riverbend Nature Center in Racine on Saturday, December 10th from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. Early registration is encouraged. Call 262-639-1515 for more information.
State news, wild turkeys are thriving, low 40s to low 50s, sunny and breezy tomorrow, highs in the 40s.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from LifeLock by Norton, reminding consumers that sensitive information sent online may not always be secure. Learn more at lifelock.com/NPR. And from the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. And from Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez. Olivia Pichardo from Queens, New York, is a freshman at Brown University. Now, that achievement alone is impressive, but Pichardo has made it historic. She's the first woman to make the roster for an NCAA Division I baseball team and will be suiting up for the Brown University Bears in the spring. Pichardo has been playing baseball with and against boys since she was five. I got a chance to speak with her this week about the challenges and encouragement she's felt, from collegiate baseball camps in the eighth grade to her acceptance to an Ivy League school without a sports scholarship.
Brown is the school that also most fit me academically. So I got in on my own. And then for the other schools that I had offers for, they had very good baseball programs, and the coaches all really valued me as a person and as a player. But I just had to make that tough decision of thinking about my future career options.
Your dad put you in collegiate baseball camps in the eighth grade. When was the moment when you're at these camps when you're thinking, you know what, maybe I can do this?
At these camps, there are a lot of eyes on me from the coaches, the parents, and also the players, hearing their reactions whenever I did the most mundane things. That was pretty crazy. And then during the actual games, I would get extra base hits and get a lot of cheers, more so than when other players would do it. And every year I just kept getting better.
So let's be clear here, Olivia. You're outperforming boys at these camps, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, you think the cheers were coming from people who maybe didn't expect what they were seeing out of you?
Yeah, I think that there is definitely a lot of surprise because it's not very common to see a girl playing baseball, much less at the collegiate level, which is what I was trying to do at those camps.
Did anyone ever try to maybe discourage you or maybe make you think, well, okay, don't count on this, Olivia. I don't know if this is in the cards for you.
Countless. Like, a lot throughout all of my baseball career. It's like every time I progressed to the next level, more and more people would ask me about maybe switching to softball. And I mean, there's no shade towards softball, but it's just that I've never played softball before. Even some former coaches of mine were just like, oh, well, season's over, so that was a great baseball run for you. And yeah, just like focus on academics now. It just feels very good to know that they also know that I'm doing this.
So these people would actually basically close the door on you, right? I mean, that's essentially what they're saying, right? It was a nice run, Olivia, you know, nice, run for what you were able to do. They were essentially closing a door on you.
Yeah, exactly.
So how did you react to that?
I remember what people say to me, like, I'm not going to snap back at you, but my actions are just going to prove otherwise.
Your coach at Brown called what he saw out of you the most complete walk-on tryout that he had ever seen from a player since the time he became a head coach. So what do you think impressed him the most?
What comes to mind immediately is when I was doing my infield evaluation and I was at shortstop and he hit a ball up the middle towards second base. And I made a forehand catch and did like a spinny move and made a perfect throw to first base. So I was just trying to show off my athleticism, show that, you know, I have my smooth mechanics. And I think that was probably pretty impressive for him.
When I saw the headline of what you accomplished, I got really excited when I saw your position listed as utility, which means you're going to be at short, at second, in the outfield, and maybe even pitch. What do you think you'll be your biggest challenge playing Division I baseball?
I would probably say not allowing the moment to get too big and trying to really just about my mentality. I think that might be probably the biggest challenge for me.
I would bet a lot, Olivia, that you're a hero and a role model. Has anyone reached out just to try and make contact with you?
Yeah, a lot of the other girls who I know who play baseball have reached out to me on Instagram DMs and I've taken the time to go through every single one of my DMs that congratulating me and making sure that I get back to all of them. So it definitely, it feels very good to know that I'm now opening up this door for them. My reason for playing baseball isn't to be a pioneer, but just by me doing this, it by default, it makes me a pioneer. So it's definitely a strong motivator for me to keep going and to be my best.
Are you worried at all over negative reactions? How have you thought you might handle that?
I've already dealt with that, to be honest. Not on a stage as big as this one, but I have pretty good tunnel vision, which is not an invitation to test that, but I'll have to see how I am in the moment, but I can probably say that I will not give much of a reaction, and I'm not really worried about it very much. I mean, there's already lots of arguments going on Twitter and Instagram, which I'm ignoring.
So February 24th, the Brown University Bears, they open the season at Georgia State. Now, what you've done is real now, definitely. But I think that day, opening day for you, is when it'll get all really, really real. So how do you imagine that first at bat might feel for you when you technically will make history again?
I'm just going to focus on my breaths. Don't let the moment get too big, even though the moment will be big. And yeah, just try to focus on myself and be in the moment.
So I'm just going to give you a piece of advice as a broken down old baseball player. If it's a first pitch fastball down the middle, Olivia, just rip. Just swing, try to pull it, do whatever you can to take that thing out of here.
Okay. I will listen to that.
That's Olivia Pichardo from Brown University, first woman to make it on an NCAA Division I baseball team. Olivia, congratulations again, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is NPR News.
In an historic first, the world's richest countries will pay into a pot of money meant to help poorer countries deal with climate disasters.
I think that this is a big victory for all of those who've suffered from the devastation of climate change.
I'm Ari Shapiro, Pakistan's foreign minister, on what this means and what more could be done this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear that story and all the day's news, including news from around Wisconsin. Brady Carlson, your host for that. All Things Considered from 4 until 6:30 today.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
It's 8:30. Thanks for joining us this Thanksgiving Day on WPR. Morning Edition continues now with news from NPR and WPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The mayor of Ukraine's capital says roughly 70% of Kyiv is without power following the latest Russian airstrikes. Russian forces attacked cities across the country yesterday. One strike hit a hospital maternity ward in the south of Ukraine near Zaporizhia, killing a newborn. Ukraine says it shot down 50 to 70 Russian missiles fired in these latest attacks. Police in Chesapeake, Virginia say they're still investigating a motive for Tuesday night's deadly shooting at a Walmart store. Six people were killed and several others wounded when police say a store manager opened fire on his co-workers. Investigators say the attack ended when the 31-year-old took his own life. A lot of people in the U.S. will be traveling over the long Thanksgiving holiday weekend. Here's NPR's David Shaper.
AAA estimates nearly 49 million people are driving for Thanksgiving, most of them leaving home yesterday, which gave us some of the worst traffic jams of the entire weekend. The mobility data analytics firm INRIX projects where the worst congestion will be and finds that there will likely be some pretty bad traffic jams on Sunday when many of us return home. And they're even predicting some heavy traffic on Saturday in a lot of cities as well.
In news, people are lining the streets for the annual Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. This is NPR News from Washington.
With Wisconsin Public Radio News, I'm Peter Bryant. Wild turkeys are thriving in Wisconsin more than a century after they were nearly hunted out of existence. Now the birds are even flocking to cities and suburbs. Julie Whitholm is a biologist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. She says humans have little to fear from wild turkeys and that it's fine to confront them if they get aggressive.
You can definitely stand your ground and kind of yell and be loud. And if it's your yard and you have like a hose or a water source too, you can spray them with that.
So far this year, the DNR has granted permits to three municipalities authorizing them to kill or relocate turkeys that are deemed to be a nuisance. People who are traveling to see family this holiday season should take precautions to avoid spreading three respiratory viruses that are circulating in Wisconsin. The virus RSV can be dangerous for children and the elderly. RSV infections in Wisconsin have spiked in recent weeks. At the same time, flu season has come early this year, and COVID-19 continues to circulate. Dr. Jasmine Zapata with the Department of Health Services says people should be aware of the risks.
This can be a very scary time, but we want you all to remember that there are preventive measures that you can take to help prevent the spread of COVID-19, flu, and RSV in your children.
RSV spreads through droplets from coughs and sneezes, which means thorough hand washing and surface disinfection can help limit its spread. And officials say people can protect themselves and others against COVID and the flu by getting vaccinated. The annual survey of grocery store prices by the Wisconsin Farm Bureau found many common foods used for Thanksgiving dinner are more expensive this year. The informal survey found a meal for 10 people cost over $74. That's about 4% more than last year, but overall prices in Wisconsin went up less than the national average. A mix of clouds and sunshine forecast today. Some scattered light rain showers possible, especially by the afternoon. Highs today in the low 40s to low 50s. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. You can find more at WPR.org.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil, a fiber supplement containing psyllium, a plant-based fiber for trapping and removing waste in the digestive system, designed to be taken every day. More at Metamucil.com. And from DataIQ, a platform for everyday AI. Humans make AI part of their daily business, designed to elevate people, teams, and companies. DataIQ.com.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez. While young Iranians continue 2 months of street protests, the U.S. and other countries are looking at whether there are things they can do to support their demands for more freedom. The United Nations Human Rights Council is discussing it today in Switzerland. Beth von Skak, who heads the State Department's Global Criminal Justice Office, says that it's a step in the right direction.
We know that young people are really in the lead here and that young people have borne the brunt of this crackdown. The Human Rights Council has not in the past really focused its attention in a laser way on Iran, and the recent events have finally sort of woken that institution up.
But what can the international community really do? Joining us to talk about all this is NPR's Michelle Kelman. All right, Michelle, so first of all, tell us about this meeting in Geneva and what's expected.
So the plan is that they'll set up a group that will kind of sift through the evidence of human rights violations and gather material that could eventually be used in trials against Iranian officials. These protests began over the death in custody of a young Iranian woman back in September, and activists say several hundred Iranians have been killed since then, including many teenagers. Thousands have also been arrested. There are reports of torture and execution, lots of online video evidence. An Iranian-American human rights lawyer, Guy Sunia, told me that a UN fact-finding team could help verify these videos and reports. Take a listen.
Having a dedicated team that can do that and sort of put the imprint of an international independent investigative process is really key, in my view.
And she says that would give the world a clearer picture of what's happening in Iran and can help shape the international response.
the U.S. and Europe have also been imposing sanctions on Iranian officials that are involved in the crackdown. Is there any more they can do?
Yeah, there are actually more names added to a U.S. sanctions list just this week, and that will likely continue. There are also some other kind of more symbolic things that can be done to isolate Iran diplomatically. Many Iranian women and their supporters abroad want Iran kicked off the U.N. Commission on Women, for instance. The U.S. says it's working on that. There's going to be a meeting in New York in early December to discuss ways to get Iran off that commission or at least suspended from it.
But most of these things are what, symbolic? So why not do more?
Well, you know, the U.S. is working with tech companies, for instance, to help Iranians communicate with each other and get around internet restrictions. There's always a danger, though, that this kind of direct support could backfire and put protesters at even more risk, because Iranian leaders always accuse the U.S. and Israel of fomenting unrest in the country. They call these protest riots. And activists say that's one reason why it's important to bring these issues up at the U.N. and get non-Western countries on board to pressure Iran.
Now, before the protest, the big question was a nuclear deal, and that's aimed at preventing Iran from making nuclear weapons. Where does the nuclear diplomacy with Iran fit into all this?
Well, Iran's been making major advances to its nuclear program, and the White House says it's watching all that with deep concern. The U.S. still thinks the best way to contain Iran's nuclear program is through diplomacy, but it says Iran has been adding too many demands, and the world's focus now is on the protesters.
All right, that's NPR's Michelle Kellerman. Michelle, thanks.
Thank you.
Brazil, one of this year's favorites to win the World Cup, plays its first match later today. Now, fans at home are not sure about sporting the team's national jersey, which during the recent contentious presidential contest became synonymous with Brazil's far-right president. NPR's Kerry Kahn has a story.
It's become a familiar sight at marches and rallies of the nationalist supporters of Brazil's president, Jair Bolsonaro. Nearly all wear the canary yellow soccer jersey and wave the national flag. Symbols, they say, are emblematic of their movement led by Bolsonaro. The right-wing leader who narrowly lost last month's re-election bid left the country deeply divided. He's claiming fraud, and his supporters are still protesting and still wearing the jersey.
Vou tentar não colocar o verde nem o amarelo.
That's why some sports fans, like Vanessa Morales, says they won't wear the jersey, even while watching the national team possibly win a Hexa, a sixth World Cup title. She doesn't want to be confused with a Bolsonaro party supporter. A party that ended up taking over our T-shirt. She says it's sad not being able to wear it anymore. Instead, she'll wear her local red Flamingo team's T-shirt, like she's doing at a recent parade in Rio de Janeiro. She says hopefully in the new year, when Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva takes office, Brazilians will wear the national soccer jersey once again. Lula's supporters aren't waiting that long. They've created their own version of the famous jersey, says vendor Renato Monteiro, making brisk sales in an outdoor market in Rio de Janeiro.
Nós resgatamos o símbolo da nossa pátria.
Monteiro says we've rescued our homeland from Bolsonaro with the jersey-style T-shirt. It sports a picture of the bearded president-elect on the front and Lula's election candidate number 13 on the back. It belongs to the people and we've taken it back, he adds. And profits aren't bad either. He says he sold 20,000 in the run-up to the World Cup. But Brazil's Soccer Confederation wishes the country would just put politics in the past.
Qual receita te faz campeão? Levanta, faz tremer o chão.
It's running this ad with its own take on a popular Brazilian song, encouraging pride for the old amarelinha, the yellow shirt. Come on, Brazil. Come on, yellow shirt, it goes. One of the country's biggest beer companies is hoping to focus on soccer and, of course, alcohol consumption, too. But these three soccer fans who've come to celebrate at their local team's recent parade say political reconciliation is possible. One voted for Lula, one for Bolsonaro, and together all under one color, yellow, then the country can. It's time to unite Brazil. Although he jokes, of course, that will be way easier if Brazil wins the World Cup. Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Rio de Janeiro.
Holiday starting with Morning Classics with Stephanie Elkins at 9 o'clock.
My name is John Udell. My wife, Amanda Strosol, and I live in La Crosse. We donated our car to Wisconsin Public Radio without hesitation.
Information is at focusonenergy.com.
From the WGTD Arts and Events calendar, Kenosha organist Brian Schultler presents a series of 30-minute organ recitals throughout the month of December. The recitals take place weekly on Fridays at 11:30 a.m. and are free and open to the public. For more info, visit brianschultler.com.
15 minutes before 9 o'clock, here's some of what's happening in the news today. The number of people traveling for Thanksgiving appears to be close to pre-pandemic levels. The airlines have their hands full, and tens of millions are also driving this week. The residents of Chesapeake, Virginia, are dealing with the aftermath of a mass shooting. It left six people dead and several wounded. In Wisconsin, costs at grocery stores are higher this Thanksgiving, but an annual survey of Wisconsin stores found smaller price increases than the national average. And State Senator Alberta Darling says she'll retire after a 32-year career in the Wisconsin legislature. Her departure means Republicans won't have a supermajority in the chamber, at least until a special election is held. More Wisconsin news in our newscast at 9 o'clock.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BetterHelp, connecting people with a therapist online for issues like depression and anxiety. 25,000 therapists are available through BetterHelp using a computer or smartphone. BetterHelp.com/public. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to solve social and environmental problems to improve lives today and benefit future generations. More information at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez. Every family has that one dish, the recipe that takes you back to childhood. You know the one that your mom has down pat and your grandma can make with her eyes closed. Well, starting this month, NPR is sharing your kitchen gems in a series we're calling All Things We're Cooking. We asked our audience to send us their special family recipes, and we're sharing those favorites and the stories behind them. This morning, we're starting with Miriam Armendariz Piccolo, who started sharing hearty bowls of picadillo with her mom. We spoke to her around the anniversary of her mom's passing, and she told us how she learned to make the dish with a little help from her tías.
I'm Miriam Armendariz Piccolo. Right now, I'm living in Little Rock, Arkansas. I was born in Jalisco. We grew up pretty low income in Mexico. There's a reason why we had to immigrate to the U.S. We were unintentional vegetarians. We ate a lot of potatoes, beans, cactus, rice, very, very simple foods. So this is a picadillo dish. It is ground beef potatoes with chili sauce. My dad wasn't too big of a fan of it. My brother wasn't too big of a fan of it. So when we came to the U.S., if my mom was to make this dish, this was my dish. It's the one that would say a pinch of this and add some chilies. And she was so vague with it that I was like, I don't know what that means. So I had to text my aunts. I was like, how do you guys make picadillo? Cook up some ground beef in its own fat. Peel and dice some potatoes. Throw it in there, put the lid on. At the same time that you're doing this, reconstitute into boiling water a couple guajillo peppers, like half a Roma tomato, el diente de ajo, a clove of garlic, a little piece of onion, some oregano.
you have to trust your hand, because as we get older, our hand is going to get seasoned. You're going to learn whether to grab a pinch with two fingers or a pinch with all your fingers. And as you get older, that will come to you. Once that gets cooked up, puree it, knowing that it really was made with love. You know, since she's passed, there's no news to update somebody about. You no longer share things about them. But I wanted to show my aunt that I'm still carrying my mom. You know, I still got her memories and her skills. Like, I'm still bringing them with me.
That was Miriam Armendariz Piccolo sharing her mom's recipe for picadillo. To try out the recipe and others from the series, search All Things We're Cooking at npr.org. This is NPR News.
You're tuned to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in this Thanksgiving. Morning Classics with Stephanie Elkin starts at 9 and includes music for the holiday. And between 10 and noon today, Stephanie will also include some highlights from this year's Wisconsin School Music Association Honors Concerts. It features choirs and orchestra made up of middle and high school students from around the state. We have music for Thanksgiving throughout the day from 9 until 3 today.
Support comes from the Racine Symphony, presenting its annual Holiday Pops Concert Friday evening, December 2nd at Memorial Hall, featuring singer William Tony. Join the symphony for food, drink, and a sing-along. For tickets, call 262-636-9285.
Artists and artisans. Find out more at wpr.org/events.
It's 10 minutes before 9 o'clock. Just ahead, a conversation about a new book that looks at the creative lives of animals. In sports, the Bucks lost to the Chicago Bulls 118-113 yesterday. They play the Cavaliers tomorrow night. And Green Bay Packers quarterback Aaron Rodgers said he's been playing with a broken thumb for the past 6 weeks. Clouds and sunshine mixed today. That's the forecast this Thanksgiving Day. Chance of scattered light rain showers, especially this afternoon. Highs today in the low 40s to low 50s. Some sleet is possible in parts of northern Wisconsin today.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez. When you think of undomesticated animals, what words come to mind? Maybe it's wild or even vicious. For author Carol...
That someone, whoever it is, human, crocodile, elephant, creates something that is new and meaningful to them. And that has the possibility of being handed down to a group, to a species, to a culture. And then that also may happen to actually change the evolution of that species.
Gigliotti says creativity is too often used to suggest that humans are the superior species.
I can't tell you how many times I've come across articles by scientists, other scientists, and people who say, oh, well, we are the best species because we are creative. And now you can say, nah, no, that's not true.
So what are some examples of this definition of creativity in animals?
Well, I think one of the most fascinating ones is the birds of paradise live in New Guinea. And there are, I think, 51 species. And two biologists with Cornell Ornithological Lab went to actually tape all of those species. And what they discovered was that the females actually decide what they judge the males and what kind of dances and songs they do, and also most beautifully, how they negotiate their feathers and their incredible plumage to make the song or the dance really work. So if you look at these images of these birds, they're unlike anything you've ever seen before. And if you go to Cornell's site, you will become addicted. But what's interesting about, in terms of the creativity, is they practice these songs, the males practice these songs and dances for years at a time. And the female comes and looks at it and, it's okay, goes away. So the point is that over time, the females have actually been involved in the creativity because they've been the ones who have judged whether they thought it was beautiful or not, and not whether this particular male was stronger or would be more competitive, but whether he was more beautiful and more creative himself.
Yeah. And I think, Carol, you know, the funny thing is, so I've seen these videos that you mentioned with these birds of paradise, and it is beautiful and it is amazing. And I can't imagine that someone would look at that and not think that these animals are showing a creative side. There was another example that really struck me from your book, Carol, about prairie dogs, their warning calls, and how different their warning calls could be from region to region.
That's really exciting. The person who put prairie dogs on the map was Khan Slobachkov, who has a book called Chasing Dr. Doolittle. And Dr. Slobachkov, I interviewed, and what he did was to study prairie dogs for years and years with his students and demonstrate and document their language, which has a syntax, you know, separation of words and actually being able to say, well, this is the object and this is, but it means that those kinds of processes go on among animals. And the other thing he found was that there were very creative things that they did. The first time that they saw something that was different, it was an oval, a black oval, and they had a different warning call for that than they did for all the other predators. The other funny thing about that I thought was really interesting was that they also could describe humans as not as a predator, but yeah, kind of, because they get really kind of
a lot different than a prairie dog somewhere else.
Yes, yes. And you're right. That happens with whales. The kinds of songs that whales create in, you know, the Atlantic are very different from the Pacific. Though, at some point, sometimes those mix, and somehow, you know, a song will get passed along. And how that happens, they're not really sure.
Now, there may be some surprise and skepticism that animals are displaying kind of an attitude instead of what, you know, maybe just being perceived as ritualized behavior. So why do you think, Carol?
Animals, in many ways, eating them, wearing them for clothes, you know, making them work for us, they've always, and maybe not always, but they have been useful to us. And I don't think many people are not ready to give that up. And I do think that the human has the ability to sort of push things aside if it's not good for them. And with animals, I think that's really easy to do, which is why I have believed this for a long time, but I supported every single thing I wrote in the book with research from scientists who actually spent time with animals. And, you know, I think if you look at all the research being done and you look at the science, I think you will, I hope people will begin to understand that, yeah, maybe we should rethink our use of animals. Maybe we shouldn't eat them, or maybe we shouldn't wear them. Maybe we shouldn't use them in experimentation. If they're that smart, emotional, have all these incredible qualities, maybe we've missed the boat.
That's Carol Gigliotti. Her new book is called The Creative Lives of Animals. Carol, thanks.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Ian Martinez.
You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, here for you every weekday from 5 until 9. A preview of Morning Classics is just ahead, also an update of the news. It's a minute before 9.
Support for WPR comes from Rutabaga Paddle Sports. Moving soon to a new, larger location at 2620 Rimrock Road in Madison. Located next to Lake George for on-site test paddling. RutabagaShop.com.
Support comes from the Kenosha Symphony, presenting its holiday concert Saturday afternoon, December 10th, featuring the Carthage College Lincoln Chamber singers and dancers from the Kenosha Academy of Performing Arts. Tickets at KenoshaSymphony.org and at the door. Free for kids and college students with ID. You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR